All right, guys, welcome back to another episode. It's a Sunday evening here, and the Tall Timber crew was kind enough to hop on with me and chat about elk hunting and everything else we're doing nowadays. So how are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me.
Appreciate it. Sunday evening's good because you got me out of cooking dinner. So
right on. Yeah. My wife's about to start and I'm like, whoa, don't forget. I've got a podcast. She's like, oh, I forgot. Yeah, I'm like, see, I told you you'd forget. But anyway, so, why don't you guys, tell the audience a little bit about yourselves, you know, as elaborate as you want to be or short and sweet as you want to be. And then we'll get into this thing.
Sounds good. My name is Corey Toombs and I'm part of the Tall Timber crew. There's four of us, born and raised in Alaska, moved to Southwest Washington for college, met my wife here, and the rest is history. Got my daughter's about to turn 8 years old. She keeps us busy and do everything we can to enjoy the outdoors.
Awesome. Yeah, and my name's Bryant Sentman. Part of the Tall Timber crew as well, obviously. And then I live here in the outskirts of Vancouver, just about 20 minutes from Corey. So I got my wife and three young kiddos. And yeah, we love shooting the bow, fishing, all kinds of outdoor activities. And then kind of a fun fact. So I met Corey playing basketball years and years ago after college. And then the other two members of our team, Alex and Kyle, were my college basketball teammates.
Wow.
Yeah. If any other elk crews want to, you know, play 4-on-4, I think we got some pretty good odds.
Sounds like it. Yeah. So I remember when I first started, my little page 4 years ago or so, I remember reaching out to you guys over social media and kind of picking your brains about how all this stuff works. And, I know my audience knows that, like, I never had social media and stuff really growing up. So it was like really new to me at, you know, I'm 37 almost now. So kind of started way late in the game, as far as the younger kids go nowadays. But anyways, how did this all start for you guys, the Tall Timber crew, and what inspired you guys to start filming your hunts?
Oh, where to start? I think one thing, just being in the Pacific Northwest, I'll definitely highlight, like, born and raised, right? When they started, like, they were a huge, huge pull there. Even like Angry Spike Productions, picking their brain on just the ins and outs of elk hunting on the coast, even Rogue Wild, Matt Starley and Ryan Starley. I mean, the list of people that are open to just have a conversation with you, and you're watching these elk hunting videos, and Bryant and I 10, 12 years ago were really digging in deep and wanted to get better at elk hunting. We didn't want to struggle so much. It's so hard to kill a bull with a bow, or just to kill a bull in general. And watching all of that information, listening to all the podcasts, and we just were inspired to start picking up a camera, like, and videoing our own hunts. And I mean, the first one that we videoed, looking back at it, I was like, man, that is terrible. But it was just iPhone footage of adventure in Idaho. And we're like, well, let's just see what it's like before we start investing money in cameras. And we're like, oh, it's pretty cool. And then slowly you invest in some more money into cameras, and the team expands, and you're off to the races. And we enjoy it. I mean, don't get me wrong, as you know very well, carrying all that camera gear and taking shots when you're exhausted and you got to stay up to get a shot, or you want extra sleep. I mean, there's definitely struggle there, but all in all, it's a blast. And we got a team that we can all look back on the hunts and enjoy it together and our families. And so, yeah, it's been a journey, but it's been about 8 years, since the iPhone footage, we'll call it, is when we started. So.
Yeah, I think to add to that, it was that was a fly-in hunt into the Frank Church, and I think we kind of went into high gear, and that was we started to find a little bit of success killing a couple bulls a couple years in a row, and then seeing the other groups around, and it was like, all right, this would be cool to take it to the next level to start videoing some of this stuff. And of course, that was before we had kids as well. So you have a lot of time on your hands to just dive in. But yeah, we've kept that Idaho video on there of iPhone footage just as kind of a reminder of where we started, because it's fun to see, you know, that beginning editing and video, and then kind of where you go from there. But yeah, I think as we started to build a little success, just locally filling some tags, you know, year after year, then it was like, all right, let's pick up a camera and start documenting some of this stuff that we can look at back on with family and friends.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. That's kind of how, my story is as well. I work in the construction industry, installing underground utilities. And at the time I was a pipe layer and pulled up to the job site. And my mainline digger, Jesse Sellers, pulls up next to me, you know, an hour before work starts. And he's like, "Hey, have you ever heard of these born and raised guys?" And I'm like, "No." He's like, "Do you watch YouTube?" And I'm like, "No." And so he's like, "Man, you got to check these guys out on YouTube. They're just some like Roosevelt slayers." And my buddy Jesse and his brother are as well. But anyway, I look him up on YouTube and I'm like instantly like, "Holy cow, this is sick. Like this is rad." And I don't know why it's the same thing, but it was like, you just don't see that many guys out there pursuing Roosevelt elk. And it was really cool to see those guys do it. And it inspired me as well to pick up a camera. And I have some of my first couple years on YouTube are rough, like uploaded in the wrong frame size, you know, had to zoom way in and my face is like all oblong. It's not, you know, like it's been quite the journey, but it's something that I've truly grown to like love. And you know, I never even had a camera or picked up a camera as a kid, or no one in my family is like a photographer or anything. But now that I've been doing it for quite a few years, I almost like being behind the camera more than not shooting a bull with my bow. I mean, that's pretty hard to beat, but I do really enjoy it for some reason. So it's crazy how things have, you know, grown over the last couple of years. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we have different mindsets in the on the team in terms of filming, but it's I feel like by the time November rolls around, like I'm ready to throw the cameras in the garbage and like I'm done. And then we pull out the footage after, you know, and we start putting our videos together from the year, and then I get all excited as I start rewatching it and you start putting something together. And then once it starts to become something cool to watch, then it like lights that fire again. But yeah, there's definitely some frustration, you know, like, Corey and I've watched too many 6-point bulls walk away as we like clank the tripod, or in the early days, especially, you know, we blew some opportunities, but now it is what it is. But it's, yeah, there's some frustration, but there's some excitement when it all starts to come together for sure.
Yeah. I'm jealous of your guys' crew in a good way, envious. A lot of the stuff I do is solo filmed, and obviously it looks like you guys all carry a camera around for the most part. So you guys are getting a lot of those shots that I wish I could get. So all I'm trying to say, I guess, is keep doing it, because it's really fun to watch, you know, just to see all those bulls come in and to see those shots. I miss a lot of kill shots. So to see that stuff on a good quality camera is, I know I really appreciate it. That's for sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, I mean, as you know, and Bryant just kind of alluded to, it's you watch a lot of animals walk away if you're trying to get the kill shot. And even with the team, when we started, some of that, to give you more context, Bryant was talking about a little bit. We went on our first big out of state hunt for archery elk back in the day, and we had a bright idea of trying to film just the two of us and call and have a shooter and be separated. And we're like, "Oh, we're just going to set a camera on a tripod with the shooter." And we're still, we still to this day, we're always learning. But at that point you look back and you can see the progression and growth. And back then I was like, I was going to set a tripod, pan head the camera, and pull my bow back at the perfect time. Like, what were we thinking? But yeah, and just clank the release on the tripod leg and watch the pot at the biggest bull that I would have ever killed at the time walk away, and us mad at the camera, mad at each other, like, what are we doing? But yeah, you get through all those hurdles and you see the growth, and you can laugh about it now, but it's quite the journey. Like you mentioned as well, is you see that progression and that growth and the end product, and being able to share that with not only your friends and family, but followers and the network. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Just takes one good comment from somebody that you inspired on YouTube to make it all worthwhile. You know, That's one thing I've noticed is there's always a few out there that are not the friendliest, but then there's just like the one guy that's 60 or 70, that can't do it anymore, that leaves a comment like, "Hey man, keep doing what you're doing. I'm living through you guys," you know, and it makes it all worthwhile. Of course I love sharing it with my friends and my family, but, those comments go a long ways to keep me motivated to keep packing all this crap around. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So, we also did real quick. We did a little local film night here in Battleground earlier this year and released our Wyoming video. And that was cool. It's the first time we've kind of put something out to the local community. And we had about 50 people show up. And that was really neat, too, because then you're getting some of that direct feedback of like, "Hey, we've been watching your guys' stuff for the last year and it's really good and it's been super fun. And where are you guys going?" And seeing the like 17 to 23 year old guys that were there too, and some younger high school kids that were just stoked and wanted to go do their first out of state hunts, and kind of that inspiration was really neat too.
Yeah, I wish I could have made it to that. I saw you guys post that, but like I was telling Corey before you hopped on, just so freaking busy right now with both my kids. Are one's in soccer, one's in baseball. I'm coaching the baseball team and work. It's just no free time right now, but yeah, next time I'm going to try to make that.
Important to get that stuff in the off season, that's for sure.
Yep.
Yeah, I love, my wife volunteered me to coach for the baseball team. And at first I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to dedicate that much time to it. And now I'm glad I'm doing it. It's been pretty fun.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You got voluntold.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to get into the elk obsession. So I know this is season two. Normally by now I would have watched, all of them so far, but I haven't seen all of them yet. So I want to talk about like, why did that start? How did it start? And, I'm assuming you guys plan on doing that every year moving forward now.
Yeah. Yep. That's the plan, is we'll probably tweak things a little bit, you know, as, depending on how tag draws and stuff, but it was, two seasons ago, we were still kind of putting individual videos out here and there without really a structured plan on kind of how, we wanted each fall to go. And we really kind of did some soul searching as a group. And it was like, "Hey, we absolutely love elk hunting. Like, you know, spring bear is great, mule deer is great, blacktail is great, but we're going to center our fall around elk tags." And then we have four of us, like we've mentioned. So that allows a lot of different, states and weapon types. And let's just create a project around every elk tag that we have as a group. So yeah, that was kind of how that originated. And then, that's our plan, is to keep rolling with it. It's been a lot of fun, and you'll see some mule deer, stuff on there as well, but those are elk hunts where those mule deer just happen to walk in front of us and we have a tag as well. But yeah, everything on Elk Obsession is planned around the elk tags that we have for that year, and really putting an elk in each one of our team members' freezers, and kind of supporting each other in different weapon types and throughout the fall.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let me ask you guys another question about, I'm assuming you guys have got some partners in the industry at this point. Are you guys networking with them to help cover some of these expenses with all the camera gear and the travel fees and stuff like that? Are you guys forking the bill out for everything all on your own?
We have some really, really good partners in the space that over the last, since we've started, slowly built those relationships, built that trust, and, which you'll see in our group is we've used the products before we even built that professional relationship with them. You can see that with Phelps Game Calls and XO and across the board and products that we trust and we've been using. And so, and you go into tags, right? Tags are so expensive, and licenses and fuel. And I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so, well, we're able to cover a good chunk of that. But when we're talking about time away and things like that, we're just happy that we can kind of put a dent in those costs, for those projects, because ultimately we would be doing this even if we didn't have our YouTube channel. It's what we love to do. And we'd be out there hunting and Just the fact that we get to network with those like-minded individuals and they have the same shared passion. And we're swapping photos during the season with our partners. And so, yeah, we do have a very solid group of partners that we've kept it small for a reason is how I would highlight it and what we've taken a approach around. But they definitely help with the project overall, year two and planning on year three.
Yeah, that's good to hear. It's a question I get from time to time. So I'm sure some of the guys listening or gals listening to this video are gonna, or this podcast are curious. You know, that's always, for me, I feel the same way. Like when I first started connecting with companies, it was equipment that I had already purchased with my own money, right? Like I only wanted to use stuff that I truly believe in and I'm gonna have in my pack, regardless of a partnership or whatever you wanna call it. But, you know, you always start with like a free bugle tube or a free shelter, or a free sleeping bag, you know, with equipment. Right. But then like at a certain point, you kind of get to you want to take that next step. Right. And, it's always interesting navigating that, you know, because like you said, we're going to be doing this stuff regardless of the partnerships or the YouTube channels. But like, you know, for a guy like myself, I really want to start being able to bring a camera guy or somebody else with us to help capture some better content and to showcase the gear that I love to use and to get better footage of the animals and all that stuff. So that dynamic's always, I'm not a good salesman of my, like, you know, I'm a construction guy. So like trying to ask these companies for money is always really awkward. And I really don't enjoy that part of it, but it is a conversation that comes up from time to time. So, I guess for my own curiosity, I was wondering how you guys kind of navigated that. Sounds like you have a good plan though.
Yeah. It's just been a, like Corey stated, and you as well, a walk before you run. I think we even just started with some discounts in the industry. It was like, we could get 40% off, right? For like a pro deal. And that's kind of been our whole strategy with this, you know, especially look back at some of our earlier stuff, like we were just totally doing this for fun and our quality wasn't great. And it's still sometimes not the greatest. So it's, you know, we're going to slowly build this relationship, use the products that we like and have trusted. And then those have slowly developed into, okay, well now you're getting free gear and okay, now we're supporting you a little bit monetarily. And we've noticed that, you know, advice for others is just have a plan. That's where, you know, in the beginning, we didn't have much of a plan. It was like, well, we're going to go hunt like normal and we're going to film some of our hunts. Well, surprise, they don't really, you know, that's not very surprising and intriguing for someone to open their checkbook. So when we started getting a little more serious about a plan of how we were going to lay out the season, what we were going to capture, where we were going to go, and then the timelines of when we wanted to edit that and roll it out. And if they start to see some of that happening, you know, with those couple years worth of relationships that you've built up, now they're willing to start supporting you. And I think it's also, you know, you have to keep in mind that a lot of these quality products are small niche brands, you know, they're not giant companies, so they don't have some unlimited checkbook. So that's another thing to keep in mind, that if you want this specialty gear, a lot of times it's pretty small companies that don't have a ton of marketing dollars to shell out.
Definitely. I also think it's important to take it slow because these companies have got to get to know the person that's behind the camera and that's on these hunts, and you're representing their, you know, their equipment or their backpack or their whatever it may be. And you know, they don't know you that well, right? They get to talk to you on the phone or over a Zoom or through text or whatever here and there. But, you know, I mean, they're putting a lot of trust in a guy like you to, you know, put their logo in on YouTube and wear their stuff. And I'm sure they don't want, you know, bad marketing or, you know, whatever it may be. So it's one thing I've learned that, you know, if you're in this for the money, you're definitely doing the wrong thing in my opinion, but, you know, take it slow. Good relationships will come naturally and just, you know, let it take care of itself.
Yeah. I think, I was listening to some of your podcasts over the last couple of weeks. And one that stood out to me was, your interview with Eric with Hush. And I mean, he echoed a lot of this, right? You mentioned in a lot of areas in sports, for example, you get, I'm the NBA champion now. And then you have all this attention and people calling you, or I'm the fastest track athlete in the world. I just won the 100 meter dash, and all these people flood. Like, there's not really a quote unquote, as he put it, like a pinnacle. You don't just automatically get there overnight. And he talked about his journey with Hush, and I think we all can relate to that, and how he mentioned it is a very slow roll. And it really does come down to that trust that you build. And as Brian even highlighted, you start with discounts, and then you test the gear, and then you're providing feedback about the gear. And now maybe the gear is provided to you for free. And then, like, further down the road, years down the road, now they're financing, helping pay for the project. So I think things like that would just be what we would want to highlight is it is a slow roll. But if it's something you truly love and it's a passion, like it is for us, it's well worth it. And you build some really cool relationships along the way.
Yeah, totally. And you get to meet a lot of really cool people. You know, one thing about this podcast, actually this podcast was Joseph's idea from way out West. And he ended up, he's got so much stuff going on right now that I'm still trying to keep it rolling on my own currently. Hopefully he'll get some free time and jump back in with me. But, just being able to meet guys like you and Eric, and, the list goes on and on and on, you know, it's been really cool to meet people that are like-minded and be able to pick their brain and talk about, you know, strategy for applications and gear and camera stuff and, you know, editing software. And so many of the guys out there are just, you know, like-minded, hardworking dudes that they're easy to get along with and easy to chat with. So, yeah. But anyway, I want to ask you guys about Roosevelt Elk Hunting. So obviously we all live on the coast, all three of us. And, I've been hunting out of state for quite a while now. And I personally feel like finding elk out of state, I don't want to say it's easier. I guess what I'm trying to say is you can kind of hop on Google Earth or Go Hunt Maps or Onyx, whatever software you like to use. And everyone can look at north facing slopes and burns and beetle kill. And I feel like if you put in the work, you're able to find elk, not easily, but you're going to get into them. You know what I mean? Like most trips. Now hunting Washington, for example, logging country, good patches of timber don't last long around here. They usually get cut down pretty quick. So I found myself over the years, like, you're going kind of cut to cut, patch of timber to patch of timber. And it's almost like you can't just hop on Google Earth or Go Hunt Maps or Onyx and pick a north face slope that's 3 or 4 miles in, that's, you know, 3/4 of the way up the ridge, and go find elk, right? Like, they're in these little pockets, drainages. It's a totally different game. So for the guys out there that are chasing Roosevelts on the coast, have you guys figured out any tactics or strategies or anything over the years that you feel like have helped you be a little bit more successful chasing those elk around?
Well, I think one of the things that started helping us a lot in the beginning was just getting out in the summer and finding some master vantages and just start using your glass into those logging cuts. Cause I think that's something we think of a lot when we're going to Idaho or Wyoming or these more open areas, but there, if you work and you do use Google, you use Onyx, just like we do, like, get up to a master vantage and, look for some of those cuts, and especially in the summertime when animals aren't being pressured, you know, they're out feeding earlier in the, like, later into the morning and earlier in the evening. And that's just kind of identifying where they want to be, what age of cuts they like to be in. I think the age of logging cuts has been huge. And then that can kind of change throughout the season with pressure. But yeah, just using our, we used to never use our glass early, like in this coastal country. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to still do that. And I like that summertime just because the animals aren't pressured and, you know, they're going to be out and visible.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned, I've lost quite a few trail cameras to good timber patches. I tell you that. Yeah. They don't last long at all here on the coast. So come back and I was like, this was prime, and now my cameras are gone. But I'll echo what Brian just mentioned, just all year long too. Even if you have the time, and maybe it's a season that you don't even have a tag for, or late into the year in December, early spring, all the way to the summer. I know it's more work, and we're trying to make it as easy as possible, but there's no real shortcut. It's just getting glass up and observing where elk like to be, those cow pockets are, and just how they move through the timber cuts and what age class that they prefer. Really it's just putting boots on the ground and eyeballs behind the glass to figure that out over time. And then you can start to piece it together, right? Then you can go to OnX and you can go to Google Earth and you're like, okay, I'm constantly seeing cow pockets here. I'm constantly seeing, bachelor groups of bulls in these areas during the late season. So you can narrow down if you're hunting rifle versus archery. And then you can really start pinpointing and cutting down that learning curve. So when you go out to scout, you have a better chance of walking, coming into an ideal area or a target rich environment, to help with that. But really for us, I think Bryant would echo this too. It was just boots on the ground and a ton of time in the woods, in season, out of season, and, failing a lot in all reality, failing over and over again, but learning from those mistakes so that we could piece it all together.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's pretty much what we figured out as well, is just try to get out in the spring. The elk are out a lot more, deer out a lot more. Start marking them on your maps where you're finding big groups of cows and bachelor groups of bulls. And the more pins you drop and the more groups of elk you find, kind of gives you a good place to start. You know, when the season comes around, okay, come to this drainage, they're here, they're not here. If they're not, you have, you know, plan A through pretty much Z at that point. If you've been out enough, you've marked a ton of elk. So yeah, it's just a totally different game over here. It's hard to explain to the people that have never hunted the coast. It's just such a different approach to kill an elk over here with a bow. But that kind of brings me to my next question. So have you guys noticed a difference in aggression or in call-ins between the Roosevelt elk and the Rocky Mountain elk? Like, do you find that one or the other is more aggressive and more willing to kind of come in to the calls the first time you encounter with them? Or have you guys not really seen a difference between the two?
I would say I've seen a difference. And how I would highlight it would just be, it is harder to get a response from a Roosevelt bull. That's again my experience, but when you do get a response from a Roosevelt, if you have experience and know what to do with that response, you have a really good chance of at least getting into archery range and having a good encounter with that bull. Where in Rocky Mountain elk country, there's times where we're trying to sleep or even in the morning, you're like, I'm shocked I'm saying this, but shut up. Like, they're just constantly bugling and they're just talking to each other. And if you join in, really, you're not adding anything to it. They're just going to their bedroom or they're feeding. But in Roosevelt country, I mean, that doesn't happen. Obviously they'll be vocal, but if you get a response from a Roosevelt, you have a pretty good chance of having an encounter outside of pressure or predator ruining that. So I would say a little more aggressive when we find them in the right temperature. When they're ready to go and they're vocal, they seem to be quite a bit more aggressive.
Yeah, I would echo that, like, the same completely. Obviously, there's been so many nights where, like, I can remember my first trip to Idaho, like, super vividly. We hiked into an area, got in there just before dark. We pulled the teepee out of the backpack and we're making a ton of noise. Like, you know, it's rustling. It sounds like a bag of paper or, chips, like ruffles or whatever, like just setting the teepee up, and a bull just pipes off like 300 yards above us. And we haven't even bugled yet, you know? And I'm like, holy cow. Like, did we just like luck out or what? Well, anyway, we get to bed finally and there's elk bugling all night long, to the point where you're like, I'm never going to get any sleep back here. And it continued like that for the whole trip, like 10 days. They just rip all night long, and you wake up and you're like, okay, there's a bull bugling to the left and there's a bull bugling to the right and there's a bull bugling over here. So you, like, it's a huge target rich environment. But what I would say following that is, like, those elk seem to wind arc like nothing like Roosevelt's. Like Roosevelt bulls, when you find one that answers, they seem to come in like on a string. Now, if you're going to get a shot or not, it's a whole nother scenario because it's way thicker over here and all that stuff. But the Roosevelt bulls that we've had encounters with, man, most of them that we haven't been winded by, they come in on a line and they're in archery range. The Rocky Mountain elk, they seem to be a little bit more, I don't know if they're timid or what, but they definitely seem to kind of play the wind. And, you know, sometimes they just quit calling and don't come in for, you know, God knows what reason, right? You didn't get winded, but they just quit calling and disappear. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to hear you guys say the same thing, pretty much same experience.
Yeah, I think you guys hit the nail on the head. It seems like the, you know, a good Roosevelt bull, when he's bugling, he's a killable bull. And that, you know, does not necessarily mean the same thing with a Rocky Mountain bull. Like they bugle because they stretch their legs in the morning. They bugle because they're walking, you know, they just like to bugle. And I think the only big difference in tactic for us is in the Roosevelt woods, you know, from the time we get a response to the time we're going to try to call that bull to us, we're covering a lot more ground. You know, we're trying to really get tight in Roosevelt country versus with Rocky Mountains. I mean, some of that's terrain specific, but I feel like with Rocky Mountain bulls, a lot of the times, if you get too tight right off the bat, they almost like will just kind of move off or push their cows away. It's like you've kind of, you know, you kind of spooked them or surprised them, where I think just the Roosevelts being more territorial, like they just want to come check you out, even if they're not willing to fight. It's like they're kind of want to size you up or see what's going on. So but we're trying to really, like, if we don't have to, we're not afraid of making some non-vocal noises on our way to that bull, but we're not going to try to bugle again until we're in, you know, 50-60 yards. We're almost in bow range, you know, with a Roosevelt, where we're probably going to stop at 150 in Rocky Mountain country and kind of see, like, is this a satellite? Is it a herd bull? What's going on? Maybe get another response. But yeah, we're definitely a little more aggressive in covering ground in Roosevelt country for sure.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that, yeah, to jump on that, I just, to Bryant's point with the Roosevelts being so territorial, I think with the Rocky Mountain elk, you get in tight and they just cover so much ground. And so when they feel that pressure, they're like, oh, I'm just going to go another mile like I normally do on a daily basis, or go another 2 miles or whatever the case might be. Where in Roosevelt country, it's like, this is my home. This is where I live. You're coming into my house and I'm going to come face you. And that's just in their nature, it seems like, because they're not going to move, at least in our experience, they're not going to move around near as much. And that's one of those things that, even though it's hard, because most places you can't glass them, especially in their bedding areas. But when you do find them, you have a good chance of, over the season, working that bull and finding them on the right day, or working in tight and hey, I know this area. So I know here are two or three areas that they're going to go bed in, and I can find my way into their bedroom. And so there's a lot of options there, but I would say the hardest part, right, would just be finding where those areas are on the coast, like you mentioned when we first started this combo. And that just all comes back to time in the field.
Yeah. Yep. So let's talk about strategy a little bit. So obviously you guys do a lot of backpack hunting, but as I've hunted out of state more, and I've, you know, my game has evolved a bit. When you guys pick an area to go archery elk hunt in September, are you guys loading up the packs for, you know, 10 days at a time, and you're kind of like dedicated to that one big main drainage, and, you know, you're going to bounce around a little bit from there? Or do you guys kind of like day trip a little bit more, or maybe 3 days of food and kind of stay mobile? What's your guys' strategy that you found that has helped you be successful hunting out of state?
I think ultimately it's just putting that hunt plan together. Brian, I really like having that list, right? A, B, C, D, E, and down the line. And then those hunts can all range from, it could be a day trip. It could be, hey, we're going to bring enough gear for 2 to 3 days and we'll bounce in, bounce out. If we see what we like, then we'll come back out and get more food and go back in. But we're not going to fully commit to one area for 10 days. And I think, at least speaking for myself, early on, that was a little bit of the the style, and then you get in there and you're like, wow, I'm really committed. I just went really far back in here. I'm 5, 6, 7, 8 miles, whatever it might be. And now it's going to take a whole day to get camp picked up and back out. And so my preference is really to bounce into a lot of different areas and stay mobile. We're not going to set up a, nothing against wall tents, but we're not going to set up a huge wall tent and have a bunch of trailers set up, and it takes a day, day and a half to get everything tore down. Really, we want to stay as mobile as we can. That way, if we pop into an area, we don't see what we like, we can quickly pop back out and be back into another area during prime time, if it's an evening or morning session to glass, or get into a spot. So I would say really it's going to be a terrain specific, area specific, but really it comes back to staying as mobile as we can possibly be, especially in new areas.
Yeah, I think, definitely popping in and popping out has been the more common thing as of lately. And that's, it kind of depends on how confident we are and where we're going to. Like if we've gotten some good intel from some friends or buddies or, you know, about a certain area, and they were there the season before that, and they were like, it was loaded with bulls, then, you know, we might pack a couple days worth and let's see what we find. But if it's just us e-scouting something, kind of going in there blind, and I would say a lot of times we're targeting that like 3 to 5 miles is like our sweet spot. And that's easy to pop in and see if you see anything, maybe stay one night, or I would say more commonly go in, bugle in the morning, see what we're seeing for sign and rubs and get out, you know. And that's my Wyoming hunt this year. Like we did that exactly. We'd seen some elk down in there, but it was an area that was far enough. We could have stayed a few nights and we're like, no, let's get down in there. Let's hunt it. And then let's come out. And if it doesn't work out or we want to reload and go back in there, we can, or we can start moving. Cause I think just covering ground has been, you know, the best tactic and probably a big proponent of our success is just cover, and by covering ground, I mean switching areas consistently until you find what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny when you first start this backpack hunting thing and hunting out of state, you know, I think it's a common mistake that's made by a lot of guys, including myself, is you overcommit to an area, you know, you're so jacked up. I remember our first trip to Idaho when you could still just drive over there and buy tags like over the counter for real. You know, we picked one drainage and, you know, luckily we ended up killing a bull in there like the last afternoon of our trip. But, you know, we were committed to that one spot. Like we didn't have plan B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, like all the stuff we have now. I it was just kind of like, we're going to go here and hopefully it works out. We set up the wall tent and the whole nine. And as the years have gone by, we've kind of noticed the same thing, that you're better off to have like, you know, as many good solid hunt plans as possible put together, and, you know, take the time to label them in your phone in your notes or however you want to do it. But, you know, this is plan A or 1, 2, 3. So like when you're out there, if you're not finding elk or deer, whatever you're hunting in that first zone after, like, you know, if they're there within a day or two, right? Like you're going to see the sign, you're going to hear them talking and all that stuff. So I think it's really critical to the guys that are maybe just getting into this, you know, out of state backpacking stuff, to take the hunt plan super serious. You know, everyone wants to shoot their bow and they want to build their arrows and lift weights and do all that stuff. But I think your hunt plan is like, it's got to be the most important thing to you, in my opinion.
Yeah, because it's easy to forget when you get out there too. So like we list like a drainage name, and then we'll list like, all right, go to this glassing knob on this east side, go to this bugle point. Like we're trying to, you know, this potential bedding area, like I'm getting pretty detailed in the notes, you know, cause that way when I'm out there, it's like, all right, you know, oh, we forgot to hit this. Let's go hit this. But yeah, it's definitely a big important thing to have a good hunt plan for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I'll add to that hunt plan is when you run into dead ends, right? Cause you're going to be, if you go to your first spot and you see sign, you see what you like, and, you're going to follow that sign, and you're going to adapt and you're going to change. And, I think one thing that I was early on that I would look at is I'd have a hunt plan, and then I'd be like, I have to hit these hunt plans. And I wouldn't when I went into an area, even though it might have looked pretty good or I was seeing a good sign, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to hit the next one on the list because that's what's on my list. So just enjoy it. And that's your rough draft and your backup plan. But as you're going through that, that's when, like Bryant mentioned, you're out there and you start forgetting all that e-scout, and that's your cheat sheet. But if you go into an area, now you have boots on the ground and you're looking at a spot, and through the optics, and you're like, hey, that wasn't on my radar, but that looks really good. Then, yeah, you're already in there, adjust over to that spot and see what you get into. But it's more of a backup plan for you as you're going through the hunt. It'll make you a lot more successful. At least it has for us.
Yeah, I want to touch on it a little bit this year. So Joseph and I applied for Montana. The general combo as a group, and we on our way home from a spring bear hunt, checked our emails, and we drew Montana. So obviously we were super pumped on the way home, and we ended up hunting one unit for like 4 days, right? But before we went on that trip, I had did a ton of e-scouting, and I had some pins dropped in some other units that were nearby. And this first unit was more like broken up country, more sage with like pockets of timber. And at the time, the two tracks that were in this specific unit, they didn't look like they were drivable. They looked like they were inaccessible, or it was illegal to use any sort of ATV or side-by-side or dirt bike to get up in there. Long story short, after 4 days of hunting that unit, we were finding elk, but they were so pressured from all this activity that was in there that we were like unaware of, that they weren't playing the game, right? So we were seeing bulls. They weren't answering any calls. You're kind of bumping them in the timber, hiking around. And we ended up picking up, camp and moving to one of these other units that was more of just remote country, dark, dark timber, drainages with no roads, no trails, nothing like that. And, we ended up bombing into an area just right off the side of a gravel road, parked the pickup right on the shoulder of the road pretty much, and ended up killing a bull in there the second day of being in that unit. And I just go back to thinking about that, like if we didn't have the plans in place and the pins dropped and all the hours spent prior to that trip, yeah, we were seeing bulls elsewhere, but I don't think we would have killed an elk on that hunt. So I just can't really, say it enough, like take the time, spend the hours, and put a solid plan together before you spend all the money and take all the time off work to go hunt.
Yeah, that same thing has happened to us a lot. Like right when we move, as soon as we get to a new spot, we call in a bull or something successful happens. And I think there's a couple things going. It's like you're energized because you're into new country and you're excited. You're like seeing good stuff. Also, like over the years, I've just feel like more often now, the first time you encounter a bull in your calling, like, is your best opportunity to kill him. And I think that's absolutely part of that is like, you've been grinding in a certain spot and you're like, well, this herd bull's been moving away, but he's here and the elk are here. Well, your odds, like every time you encounter him, are probably going down and down and down and down. And then you jump to a new area and you find a new group of elk that maybe hasn't had much pressure in the past week, and boom, something good happens. And that's happened to us numerous times, like our first little morning into a new spot and we're calling in a bull.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I got to ask you, you mentioned Wyoming, and I've never hunted Wyoming, but I applied this year for the first time, which I feel like an idiot for waiting so long to apply because there's a random pool and I never gave myself an opportunity in the random pool, but should draw. I'm just curious, is Wyoming what everybody says it is? Is it next level elk hunting? Is it insane? Like I've heard from so many different people.
I'd say no. I'd probably just transfer your tag over to one of us and just stay in Washington.
We don't got to get into units or anything, yeah, or zones or none of that stuff. I understand all that, but it is pretty incredible, huh?
It's been good for us. I mean, we haven't had a successful archery elk hunt every time we've been there in terms of punching tags, but Corey and I actually went on one of the trips he was talking about. We went on general tags. Was that 2019, Corey, or 2018?
19, I think.
Yeah, maybe 19, right in there. And we had one of the best archery elk hunts we've had, and we were going 4 to 5 miles in, setting up a spike camp a couple nights. And it was kind of the scenarios that you mentioned, of you in Idaho, like we'll go in, we're setting up our tent, a bull pipes off, you know? And, so there's a lot of opportunity. I think good elk numbers, you can get away from people. Like we found kind of a sweet spot where we were not as far in as the horse guys, you know, but a little past the day hunters, and we were having a lot of fun. And I think it's just the cool part about Wyoming, in my opinion, is it has that variety. Like if you want to hunt thicker timber and you want to call and you want to use that to your advantage, or you want to get up and glass, and find some opening speed and, you know, just, ambush hunt or however you want to do it. There's a lot of opportunity. So yeah, it's pretty awesome. That's for sure.
Yeah. I can't wait to get over there. I've been struggling personally with grizzlies or no grizzlies. I've noticed in my research that areas that have the grizzlies seem to produce, you know, bigger bulls, right? And I personally have not killed a bull over 300 yet. Like, you know, I've killed a handful of 6-point bulls in that, you know, 260, 270 range, but I have a goal like everybody else does in the world that hunts elk to shoot at least one bull that, you know, breaks the 300 inch mark. And I want to think that this Wyoming tag is going to give me, you know, a real opportunity at that, considering, you know, it's an over the counter tag, kind of quote unquote, but you have to wait quite a while to draw it. So it's like, I just can't make up my mind. Do I really want to deal with those damn things like every day and have to worry, like, you know, every corner I come around, or if I do kill an elk, if I'm going to be dealing with one, trying to get my meat out or not. But, yeah, I can't wait to get out there.
Yeah, that's, we went through that same decision process, and we landed on some units that were like on the fringe of grizzly country. Mm-hmm. So not, you know, not, I mean, there, it was definitely within the map of grizzlies, but as when we talked to the bio and stuff, he was like, yeah, you may encounter them. You probably won't. But we didn't hit any of the thick grizzly country. And I think we've considered that a few times on Montana stuff too. It's like, do we really want that, like, in the back of our mind? And, yeah, it all sounds fine and dandy until you're packing meat late at night or, you know, something. And yeah, it could get, you know, hairy in a hurry. But yeah, we were kind of on the fringe of grizzly country, had a great hunt. And I would say the herd bulls that we were encountering and a few of our call-ins were those 310 to 330 type bulls. So plenty of like good quality, what we would call good quality for that general tag.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Talking about packing meat out at night. So when we were in Montana and we moved to this, the other area where we ended up killing a bull, we ran into, I think it was a game warden. I don't recall if it was a game warden or like another group of hunters on, like, right before we hiked in, and they're like, yeah, there's 3 grizzlies in this area. And I'm like, okay, that's, I guess, good to know now, you know, and we're carrying sidearms, but, we ended up killing that bull, and it was right before dark, like always, it seems like, and, get this bull broke down, and we shuttled all the meat. Like, I don't know, it was pitch black at that time, but probably 200 to 300 yards away from the carcass. And, we're coming out that night, it's pitch black, no trail, just over blowdown and just a mess. Right. And, we hear this loud crash in the brush, and I'm like, freaking out. Like, I didn't scream or anything, but I'm like, man, this is not cool. Like, I know there's grizzlies in here somewhere. It's pitch black. I think it ended up being a moose, but those bears just bring like a whole nother dynamic to hunting out there. And I mean, for me personally, I don't enjoy it as much when I feel like I've got to like watch my back everywhere I'm going, or I've got to hang my food in trees, and, you know, I chew. So I got to get my chew and my toothpaste and all my food hung up away from camp, and coffee and all that stuff. It's like, you're sleeping at night, and like every noise you hear, you're like, was that a bear? Was that a bear? Like opening the tent and flashing the headlamp out, looking around for eyeballs. And so, it's going to be a tough decision to make, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
It is tough. It's just like, I don't know about you, but for us, we spend so much time hiking in the dark. Like, if you want to maximize the day, like in the morning and the evening, like, we're spending so much time hiking in the dark, and like those pack outs especially. And so, I mean, really, especially if you're by yourself, like that's like a no-go. I mean, at least for me. Like, it definitely changes a lot of things that at least we're used to doing that helps in what we think to be successful. So, but will you be with someone else on that hunt or solo?
Yeah. So my brother and I applied as a group. We had some family issues, brotherly love for a few years there. So, but everything's good to go now. So we're back at it and we both have the same amount of points. And we did apply in the special. We were at, I think, 5 points. So we were like kind of on the fringe. And I was to the point where I was just sick of it. I'm like, I'm not waiting anymore. I'm applying in the special. The way I kind of sold it to myself was, if I didn't get the Wyoming tag, I was probably going to pick up a second return, like rifle elk tag in Idaho, or go pick up an Oregon elk tag. I was probably going to spend the money somewhere else anyway. That's kind of how I sold it to myself. So I'm like, I'm going to spend the extra $1,000 or whatever it was and go in the special to, you know, pretty much make sure that we draw, hopefully. So,
yeah,
barring nothing crazy happens, we should be good to go. Yeah. But I had the Beaverhead guys on, Beaverhead Antler crew on, like, probably 6 weeks ago or so. And they hunt an area that's very, grizzly heavy, you know, a lot of grizzlies. And they were telling me story after story of running into bears on the trail and, you know, bears coming in when they killed an elk. And, like, it seemed like every day they were glassing bears and dealing with them. And I'm like, man, it sounds like no big deal when you're sitting here on a podcast, like, you know, they're still alive and no one got mauled. But like, you know, we see those stories every year of like, there was a group of guys in Idaho last year that got attacked by a grizzly bear and they shot it, I think 23 times with a 10 millimeter before it died, you know, and they got tore up pretty good. So it's like, do I really want to deal with that? You know, it's just a touchy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one thing to consider is like, that's, you know, that region is quoted, you know, they're only selling so many tags, and they're like, from our experience, we were able to get away from people and find 320 to 330 type herd bulls in areas that wasn't like the densest bear areas. So that was, I think you know, if you think about your overarching goal, you know, if it was like, well, I want this 350 bull and it, you know, he's up in this one unit and something, that'd be different. But like, if the goal is say a 300 to 320 inch bull and just have a great archery elk hunt, like, I think that can be achieved in a lot of areas where you don't have to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens.
You never know. I actually, Corey and I were out on the Washington coast and this bear that's right there, I shot with a handgun at about 10 yards. So you never know where it's going to happen. So.
Sure love those calf calls.
Yeah, we were working a bull in like the Christmas tree size reap rod, and I heard something behind me and looked back, and this bear is like walking, you know, 10 yards away, just kind of like sneaking through, coming towards us, because I was calf calling and this bull was like going nuts. And then I remembered, I was like, well, I got a bear tag in my pocket, so I just turned around and shot it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you got to take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves, that's for sure.
But it was like coming in for a little snack on some calf elk, so.
Yeah. Well, talking about bears, you guys going to do any spring bear hunting this year?
Yeah, we are. Well, I'll speak for myself. I am, but Corey didn't draw, so it's kind of a sore subject, you know. But no, there are three out of four of us got
over here.
3 out of 4 of us got tags this year, so we'll be hunting spring bear. Yep.
And you broke up a little bit. Did you say you guys drew? I'm assuming that's Oregon.
Yeah. Yep. We got some Oregon tags. 3 out of 4 of us got tags, so we're gonna be making a few different trips down. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I know I'm just trying to plan out my dates. Starting to get serious, kind of looking at the weather. I feel like every year that we've been out there, it'll slightly change a little bit on when the activity really starts to ramp up, kind of how the spring has been, how warm it's been, and when the grass starts popping. And yeah, I'm trying to look at that now and decide when I want to make my first trip.
Yeah. Yeah, right on. We drew Oregon this year as well. Oregon hasn't treated me as good as Idaho has for bears. I mean, we've been able to find bears on every trip. Last year we could have killed some bears in Oregon, but we filled some tags in Idaho. So we were being a little bit more selective on size, on the Oregon trip. Not that personally, as far as bears go, I'm not really that picky because I feel like, you know, just taking predators off the mountain is good regardless. But man, the Idaho spring bear hunts have been killer. So it's a hunt I look forward to every year. Just been locked up in the house for, you know, 4 or 5 months, and it's nice to get out and stretch the legs and, you know, see all the critters again. And yeah, it's going to be a good time.
I'm excited to hear that because, with me not drawing a tag in Oregon, going to spend some time with the three of them. But then end of May, I'm looking to make like a 6 to 8 day trip over to Idaho, for the first time to see if, what we can uncover for spring bear.
Yeah. Idaho's a good one. We could maybe chat a little bit when this thing's not recording and help you find some possibly.
Sounds good. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm getting pretty stoked. Like you said, we've shot, we try to just kill a bear, but we're selective until it comes down to the wire is kind of the way we've been, treating our Oregon tags. But earlier in our spring bear hunting, like, we were just pumped to kill any bear. And I remember the first one I shot was like, I think mom must have kicked it. It said it was reconnecting. Am I good now?
Yep. Sorry, I lost you for a second there.
Oh, that's all right. No, I was just mentioning the first spring bear I shot on the Oregon coast was pretty small. And from that point on, I was like, all right, I'm going to be a little more selective because we've killed a lot of medium sized bears. And those, you know, once they start to get a little bit of a pumpkin head on them, a little smaller ears, then, you know, you can find a lot of those medium sized bears. But we've tried to avoid the smalls now just because it's a little odd when you get up, you know, and it's a 90-100 pound, you know, 1.5 year old that mom just gave the boot a couple weeks before that or whatever. So but yeah, it's a fun hunt for all the reasons you mentioned too, being cooped up and getting out right at the beginning of the year when the weather's starting to change.
Yeah, and like Idaho, you know, if you have a deer tag or elk tag, it might not be the best bear zone, but it's a good reason to get out and go learn a new unit, you know, figure out what roads are drivable, all that good stuff, what trails are accessible, and, you know, looking for sign, looking for deer. Those deer seem to be in those same drainages when the fall comes around. They're just usually a little bit higher, or they might move over a drainage or two. But I've definitely learned that, you know, you can use the spring bear time for a lot of good things in the fall. You know, just learning the unit and learning the roads itself is a huge benefit, you know, when you get over there for the first time to hunt, you know, deer or elk or whatever it may be. So yeah, a lot of guys out there, if they're listening, you know, you can pick up a bear tag in Idaho for relatively cheap, and there's not a lot of people out. It's just a good time to learn the whole area.
For sure. Yeah. Actually, Corey and I made a trip to Idaho, a few years back for spring bear in northern Idaho, and we were glassing and looking around. We ran into these other hunters, and they were locals, and we started talking to them about elk hunting, and they were like, no, you're not coming back here to hunt elk. So we kind of caught on real quick that that was a pretty good quality area for archery elk season. And rubs don't go away, you know, they're older, but you're gonna find rubs at any time of the year. It's a little bit different type of country, but there's usually a lot of time to kill, we found, with bear hunting. You know, there's some peak activity. For us, it's been like, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, and then of course the last 2-3 hours of daylight, but there's a lot of hours in between there where you can be picking out some north facing timber to make a couple trips through, look for sheds and look for rubs or something to learn the area.
Yeah. Yeah, I found some awesome sheds on spring bear trips. Speaking of sheds, I don't really spend any time shed hunting, like just heading out for that specifically. But when I'm out there spring bear hunting, I've stumbled across some really awesome ones.
Yeah, same with us. It's kind of an extra added thing, but we don't put any effort into it either.
Yeah. Well, dang, guys, I've already had you on for an hour. I can't believe how long it's been already. I know we all got families and we all got stuff to do, so I guess we'll wrap this thing up. Why don't you guys tell the audience where they can find your YouTube channel so they can go check out the Elk Obsession stuff you guys have just released?
Yeah, you could. The YouTube channel is called Tall Timber Productions. We just released episode 6 a couple hours ago. A continuation of our Idaho trip. A lot of action there. You can also catch us at Instagram, Tall Timber Productions, and Facebook as well.
Well, right on, guys. I can't thank you enough for hopping on. And like I always say, man, we should definitely catch up again right before the season or after the season and talk some hunting stories or something.
Sounds good. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Let us know how your Wyoming plans are going and bounce some ideas off us, and we're happy to help.
I appreciate that. All right, guys. Well, you have a great night.
Okay. You too.